A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Back from a well-deserved pause break and presumably sated to the brim with feta, it's the Elena Duzzi.
You know it to be true.
I know. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I wanted to bring up pizza with you because I thought of you at the weekend. My two eldest children are 10 and 8, and I took them for pizza. I said, you can have anything you like, any topping you like. And they both said they'd like pineapple and mushroom.
That's a new combination.
It's weird, isn't it?
I would never, I think you want me to, but I would never pass judgment on what your children choose to eat. But what I can tell you is... and this comes courtesy of Robert Potts, who printed this off for me.
And he put it on my desk as well.
And put it on your desk as well, did he? Okay, well, this is a photocopy from a forthcoming book called Signature Dishes That Matter, which is a lovely Fiden edition, in which there is an entry on the Hawaiian pizza, in which we learn that it was invented almost 4,500 miles from the Polynesian source in Canada, in Ontario, by a restaurant owner called Sam Panopoulos. He was playing with the tiki trend that had blossomed post-Second World
What's
War.
What's tiki?
Grass skirts and flowers. It was named, the Hawaiian pizza was actually named for the particular brand of canned pineapple that he had to hand when he was trying to create
this. So it's Greek Canadian.
Just for fun thing, yeah. Entry ends with a salient point, I think. In 2017, the Icelandic president told school children he would ban pineapple pizza if he could, a statement he later retracted by saying that he did not have the power. Presidents, he said, should not have unlimited power.
True that. And if ever there was an example of that, I think it's the lack of power of an Icelandic president to ban Hawaiian pizzas.
It's a lesson to us all.
Yeah. Oh, God. So what does that mean, Theo? What should we take from that?
Well, I could, who knows?
Who knows? I'm going to still eat it. It's lovely. If you want to subscribe to the TLS, where unbelievably we do cover things other than Hawaiian, Greek,
fusion food.
Yeah, fusion food. You can subscribe using these offers. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19. This week, is our fawning over celebrity, the success of charisma over talent, a modern thing? And what does it tell us about ourselves? Irina Dumitrescu has written a belter of an essay on the subject and will tell us more. To tell us the sorrowful celebrity-inflected tale of Quandil Balok, the Pakistani YouTuber killed for failing to respect traditional restrictions for her sex, we'll also speak to Rafia Zakaria too. And there's a new film out called Bait about a Cornish fishing village, which you've seen there, haven't you?
I have, yes.
And happily at the TLS, not only do we have an editor who's seen it, we have our own expert on Cornish fishing in Lamorna Ash, who's writing a book based in a Cornish fishing village. Is quite a thing. So we're going to have her on and she's going to tell us about this film. Empty celebrity is part of the spirit of our wretched age. When future historians study these troubled times, writes Irina Dumitrescu, they will marvel at the relentless rise of sea levels, strong-arm politics, and Kardashians. Fame without talent means having all the external trappings of charisma without its sacred core. But how modern is it really? Irina has thought about the rise of fame babies, but notes as well that the lust for ill-deserved renown is an ancient phenomenon. Contemporary celebrity culture is a pumped-up, sped-up version of an old dance between people who want to be special and the folks who want to watch them try. And why are so many of the heroines and targets of celebrity culture women? It's a fascinating, gloriously written piece, and Irina joins Thea and me now. Irina, hello.
Hello, nice to talk to you.
Let's talk about the Kardashian family, who you say, like Antaeus drawing his fighting strength from the earth, is invigorated by mother notoriety, growing more powerful every time it seems to fall. So in what way are they poster children for our age, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure if they're poster children for our age. I think in a way they counteract our age. They provide the photo negative, if that metaphor still makes sense in today's age, to our culture. So on the one hand, we have a culture, at least in Western Europe and North America, which is becoming so much more aware, one hopes, of the ways we ought to be behaving to each other to be decent. Let me just put it that way. Some people might call it political correctness. And they go against everything. They don't care. They can break any rules. They can sell candy vitamins to children. It doesn't matter. Laxative teas. They could do it all. They can appropriate fashions from other races. And they're criticized, but it makes no difference to them.
And is that healthy in a way? Because one argument could be that you can take a degree of self-consciousness about performative behavior too far, what people call political correctness. Mm-hmm. So is it a healthy jolt of sort of heedlessness, and is that a good thing?
I don't really think of it as being good or bad. It certainly makes them a lot of money, so it's a good thing for their pocketbooks. I can't say that it necessarily helps any other human being on the planet.
Let's talk about celebrity more generally then. Is it a definition, because you quote Elton John huffing a bit about the question mm-hmm. of what a celebrity is, but does it amount to, in your view, or in the view of the people that the books you've been reading, people with more charisma or nous perhaps even than talent? There's something other than ability that is making people renowned.
Today, I think, but at the same time, celebrity has often been connected to special qualities, right, including high levels of talent. Certainly, Sarah Bernhardt was an extremely talented woman. And she was very good at performance on the stage and performance off the stage, as Sharon Marcus explains. So I do think it very often does connect to talent. It often obscures other qualities, such as the ability to lead or the ability to run a business, right? So it's the glossy exterior to those things. But I don't think there's anything about it that necessarily has to be empty.
You mentioned Sarah Bernhardt there. In what way was she the godmother of modern celebrity culture? I think that's the term that one of the books uses.
Sharon Marcus's book, right, the Drama of Celebrity, I think. She talks about how Sarah Bernhardt basically, in a sense, she invented the menu, right, or the recipe for modern celebrity. She had no compunction about breaking societal rules. She traveled all over the world, traveled in a hot air balloon, drank out of a skull, reportedly, as I write in the essay. It's quite entertaining.
We all want to do that.
She also acted into old age, which is also quite interesting, that she didn't have any compunction about acting as an older woman. Probably had a female lover, and also was creative in other forms. And so Sharon Marcus would say she really shows us the constellation of qualities that we then see in other celebrities, such as Elvis or Madonna or Marilyn Monroe.
The self-fashioning and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But is that, do you then extend that to Kim Kardashian or even her sister Kylie Jenner? Because to a certain extent, they have the trappings of success. They might even argue they've fashioned from fairly unpromising raw materials, business empires, mm-hmm. And success of a sort that is not simply counted in notoriety. Is there a legitimate line of descendants from Sarah Bernhardt to a Kardashian?
Yes, but it's like, do you know those candies that have a kind of fluid core at the center?
Yeah.
And you kind of suck for a long time and hope to get to that really delicious middle.
Where are you going with this, Irina? Yes.
I think they're like you suck for a long time and there's no center there. There's no there. This is what I find so fascinating is that they don't even seem to me, and this is obviously I'm not their main audience, but they don't seem to me to be that charismatic as human beings, right? There are certainly people who don't have to be stars or anything, but when you meet them, you have a sense of being in the presence of something special, electric, magnetic. You want to be close to them. You want to hear them talk more. And I don't really want to hear Kim Kardashian talk more.
No.
She's a beautiful woman.
But people do. Well, that's more the point. I suppose people do want to see her. I'm, for better or for worse, I'm interested in this idea that, as you put it, people turn to celebrities to feel emotion. And that can be positive or negative, and both are as satisfactory.
I think you're right. And I think the other point to what I'm saying is that really this comes out in Sharon Marcus's book, and I think it's very true. I think she's right on the money on this. Celebrity and charisma are not something that people can decide to have. And people certainly can't decide for other people what charisma or what celebrity or that sacred core, what I call that sacred core of celebrity is. Audiences give it. Audiences grant charisma to individuals, and they can also take it away.
And where does authenticity come into all of this?
I think some celebrities are very skilled at crafting an authentic image, and that sense of authenticity, whether it represents something real or not, is part of what makes them so magnetic. I think Lady Gaga is doing this right now in a very brilliant way, and I find quite effective. But with, I think the Kardashians have shown that it's not really necessary. You could do it without authenticity. You can just put on a total performance that's absolute show and plastic, and it will have its own fascination.
And maybe they would say what to one person's authenticity to them is an ability and a willingness to open the door so wide into their lives that it almost seems authentic, that they may not be.
This is all there is.
And you know, the picture of her that you talk about with the champagne where she's nude on the cover of Paper, I think the magazine was called, some of the images that she has allowed out about, you'd almost say lots of people would stop before that point, but she's willing to go further to reveal more. And that may not be authentic. It may be authentic, I suppose, but it's sort of pointing in the direction of authenticity because it's stripping yourself bare and showing the world.
Yes, although what's funny is that photo is a reproduction of another photo by the same photographer, right? So it's already a copy. It's a copy of a copy. So I think even when she's bare, she's always imitating to some extent.
Yeah. A lot of these examples we're talking about and in the essay are women.
Yes.
What are we reading into that? Are the rules of the game different for women, do you think?
I think the rules of the game are absolutely different for women. And this is a very old phenomenon, and I gesture towards this in the essay. Women who have exposed themselves to other people, and I don't mean in the sense of nudity, but performed or been in the public sphere, could be as leaders or as entertainers, have always come under scrutiny and under criticism, right? There is a very long prejudice in the West against women who are in public.
Yeah.
And we see that every time a female journalist tweets something and gets all of this abuse from trolls, but it's a very old story.
Yeah.
So to some extent, any woman taking a public role is going to come under a certain set of pretty standard criticisms, and it varies a little bit on depending on her age, right? So younger women will be called sexually available typically, or flighty or stupid, or will be painted that way by some people. Older women then get to be witches, right? So that's sort of the Hillary Clinton model, right? They're conniving, terrifying, witchy women, right? But it's usually some pretty standard models that are put onto them to try and push them out of the spotlight, basically.
But who's pushing them out of the spotlight? Because that's interesting, because although they might be demonized, they might be criticized. At one level, they're not being pushed from the spotlight. People are hungrily keeping them in the spotlight. It's just an very unforgiving for spotlight.
Well, they're dictating the terms of the spotlight.
Yeah, but right. I suppose they're not. But they're not removing them.
Yeah,
I guess is the argument.
You're right. They're being minimized.
Okay.
But I think what's hard to do is have a public role as a woman in which you simply have authority based on expertise, for example. It's not impossible, right? Your Mary Beard has a role like that, but it's rarer.
Some people might listen to our conversation, so hang on a second. Haven't you all just done the thing about Kim Kardashian that you then would say is an illegitimate thing to do? You've taken this very successful businesswoman. Her sister, Kylie Jenner, is the first billionaire teenager in world history. They've marketed themselves brilliantly. They've shown expertise in manipulating a media system to give them untold riches. And yet we're talking about them as if they're somehow empty vessels. Are we not guilty of that same problem?
I think that's definitely there. I wouldn't try to brush off that critique altogether. At the same time, they're playing with those prejudices, right? They're taking the stereotypes and just working with them. And that's their right, and it's certainly to their profit. But they're not offering another model or anything like that.
No, it's the whole thing of whether you play the game by someone else's rules or you change the game.
Well, and is there a feminist approach to this, do you think, that we should be? I mean, role models are an interesting idea, I suppose. And I've got a daughter who's 10, is even the concept of role models a kind of patronising one? Or should we be thinking in terms of, because you refer to sort of tween popular culture, which is beginning to just terrify me as I consider. You've read a book called Tweenhood. Is there hope that the sort of figures that are going to be seen by my daughter's 10, so this her generation, are they different from the Kardashians? Have they developed? Have they moved on?
Well, I have a little boy, so I can't give you a very scientific answer on that. I do think there's a lot to role models. I do think there's a lot to Instagram, right? Instagram seems to be the social medium that seems to get at the tween and young female market a lot. And that puts an enormous amount of pressure on them. I'm going to make a confession right now. I really like to watch YouTube makeup videos.
So does my daughter. Yeah.
I'm a professor of medieval literature who sits around watching YouTube makeup videos.
And there's a mashup program in that somewhere.
You're my ideal contributor.
Yeah, exactly. Will you write about that for us?
I could write about this for you.
Yeah.
So I find them absolutely fascinating, and they're this perspective into another world. And partly, they all comment on Instagram, right? Whether you get that Instagram look or criticize the Instagram look, which is a highly artificial form of makeup, right? Heavy foundation, very sculpted through shadow, right, and very perfected and polished. And this is a very identifiable look in the online makeup tutorial scene. And what I find so fascinating about it is when I look on Instagram, of course, now I'm practically an old woman. When I look at Instagram, to me, it's clear that it's all so fake, right? Yeah. And no human being can look like the people in these photos. And then many of them look quite annoying, too, at least these girls in fields, right? But young people look at these photos and see a model by which they judge themselves, right? And I've been talking about girls, but of course it's not just girls, right?
No.
It's lots of genders that are looking at these pictures and thinking, this is where I fail, this is where I fail, this is what's wrong with me, I'm not thin enough, I have too much acne, I don't have whatever, right?
Well, and that seeps in, doesn't it? I mean, the thing is, I find very striking, you can have all the role models in your family, you can have all the conversations you like in your family, but ultimately it gets in through the doors and around the windows, doesn't it? Because there's access to this material, and then it starts to set stereotypes for what a girl, just to take an example of a girl or a young woman, should look like. And that becomes the image, whatever you might say or I might say or anything else might say, that's there, isn't it? It's set the cultural temperature.
It's very powerful. And while the Kardashians certainly participate in that and profit from it, they could say they're the most identifiable symbol of it. They're certainly not the only ones. There are millions of people on there making themselves into brands and contributing to this, right? And there are very few people who are really willing to show themselves warts and all. And then they tend to make that into a brand as well.
Yeah, exactly. The hashtag no filter morning shot stuff.
Oh, God. Well, listen, Irina, I mean, A, we need to talk about this some more at some other point. B, you need to write a piece of what connects medieval spiritualism
yeah,
to
must be a connection.
Makeup, YouTube makeup videos.
All right, that's a deal.
But thank you. What a lovely thing to talk about. Irina Dimitrescu, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you too.
I once, my daughter had a birthday party and I asked...
Your daughter seems to be having birthday parties on a weekly basis.
No, she's having about once a year, I feel. And there are eight girls there and I said, oh, what do you want to be when you're older? It's the standard boring dad question. And I think six of them wanted to be YouTubers.
Really?
Yeah. And then my daughter said, I want to be a newsreader. Oh, that's... I was really, oh, great, journalism, you know, almost a proper job. And then there's a pause and she went, yeah, because that way I can get on Strictly Come Dancing. but the idea of, and you talk to loads of kids of all of that, being a YouTuber is like a thing, is a total
it's
thing.
It's a business.
Just, and it just did not exist when we were kids. And we sound very old and we go, oh, being a YouTuber sounds foreign. But it does and is, but it is a massive thing.
There was a radio, and this is slightly different, I suppose, but it is still about youth and cultivating brands from such a young age and stuff. There was a feature on the radio the other day, I think it was on BBC Radio 4, and it was an interview with a 13 or 14 year old who has built her own jewellery brand. And so she goes to school, she comes home, she does her homework, and then she spends all of the rest of the day and evening kind of working on her business and selling her jewellery and getting in touch with influencers and planning the next day's business activities and then going to school and, you know, rinse and repeat. And the way that it was being spoken about, the way she was being spoken to, everyone was just so thrilled about this thing. And I just couldn't help but feel so sad. If I had been a young listener listening to that, I would have immediately felt like total failure.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, his problem is we're about to talk about something else now, which is the same, you know. And look, we shouldn't be too old, fuddy-duddy.
Well, no,
whatever.
It's the whole line of when will children allowed to be children?
Yeah, exactly. When I was a child, all I was doing is running around bomb
like
shelters.
Theresa May.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're old. That's the conclusion.
Here's a cool fact: a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I have to admit that I had not heard the story of Kandil Baloch until I read Rafia Zakaria's review of a new book about her. Baloch was born Fuzia Azim, destined to a life of quiet marital submission. She rejected that. She left her son with her ex-husband and ran for independence, ending up as a YouTube star, the How Am I Looking girl, at odds with the conservatism of Pakistan. What happened next is sad and perhaps all too predictable, and not unconnected to our last discussion about the modern world of celebrity. Rafia Zakaria is here to give us the details. Rafia, welcome.
Hello.
Let's talk. What made Fawzia Azeem famous? How did she become a famous woman?
Well, Fawzia Azeem, who eventually became Kandil Baloch, was born in a very small village in a very ordinary and rather poor family. And her story is really a story of what is now possible in Pakistan, which means that a girl or a woman who had, who didn't have anything growing up, who didn't even receive much of an education, manages to somehow educate herself and then harness the power of social media. And, I must posture to say that, the cell phone concentration in Pakistan, it has just exploded in the past 5 years, so that a huge, huge number of the population has cell phones with internet capability, even in very, very tiny villages that are in, say, the middle of nowhere. So she harnessed that and made an identity for herself. She would post these YouTube videos. They were titillating and, often posted late at night. But she sort of kind of had a mix of taunting her supporters and goading them on to continue to follow her.
So she was kind of arch about it. She was knowing about what
extremely,
she was doing.
Extremely, extremely, yes, she was. And in a way, she was very smart about the divisions between it, the sort of, hypocrisies of Pakistan in the sense that, here were all these men who would follow her, message her, secretly send her messages and invitations to meet and whatnot. But on the surface of it, if they were asked, oh, do you like Kandil Baloch, they would likely say no, because it's not acceptable to have that sort of interest, this kind of sexual prurient interest in a woman. And she played on that. And she was bent on exposing the fact that there's this huge sexually frustrated underworld of men that exists in the country and that is never sort of brought into the daylight, so to speak, of Pakistan.
This is just a small aside. I'm just wondering, did her new name, her chosen name, does it mean anything?
Yes, Kandil means a flame or a light. So, that definitely could have had something to do with it. And then Baloch is, and there's actually been controversy of her picking Baloch as the last name because that, it is a famous, tribe in Balochistan, and she had some connection to the tribe, but wasn't really a member. So in this sort of aftermath, when everyone wanted to disassociate themselves from her, when the whole debacle happened with the cleric and Kandil, even they came out to say that, oh, this is just a fake name that she's taken on. She has nothing to do with us. We have nothing to do with her.
Let's talk about the cleric. So what did she do that was so outrageous? At the minute, we've got kind of mildly titillating, slightly ironic videos, which ultimately bait stupid, horny men, and they're the villains of the piece very clearly. Did she do things that are seen to be more outrageous than that? What happened with this telly cleric?
What happened was that by this time, she was coming on TV and there were lots of talk show appearances. And one favorite sort of little trick that these talk show hosts had would be to pit Kandil, who was obviously this YouTube star with kind of questionable piety and morals, against a religious cleric. Because she was very unabashed and she would challenge them, and she didn't hide the fact that she was titillating. She wasn't ashamed of the fact that she made the videos and that she said things that were provocative. And so this apparently happened with Mufti Kavi, who was the cleric. And according to Kandil, this man kept messaging her, sending her DMs and texts asking to meet her alone. alone. And she says she kind of rebuffed him a number of times, but he was very, very persistent. And he would actually come, to Karachi, where she was, to sit on what is Pakistan's Moon Committee, where a number of clerics gather to see if the new moon has been sighted and the new lunar month on the Islamic calendar will start. So he, during one such visit in Ramzan, which is the month of fasting and even more like you, of a sort of heightening your spiritual devotion, they come. She goes to his hotel room, and in the middle of this fasting month, they're eating and smoking cigarettes. And Kandil takes photos and makes videos of the whole thing. She sits in the cleric's lap. She takes his hat, which is like a kind of hat that's usually worn by clerics, puts it on her head. I mean, and essentially takes some very kind of licentious looking photographs for a cleric.
But this was obviously with his consent. I mean, he was party to this.
Yeah, but it's odd because it seems that he didn't truly understand what would, the outcry that would result, or that she would actually put these out. She was never without her phone. She was recording this sort of internet life of hers, like all other sort of YouTubers and Instagrammers do constantly. But he just seems to be either, I don't know if he was in his senses. That's a question I've puzzled over myself.
And is it not typical that as ever, it's the woman who gets the blame for this? So two adults acting this way, and the focus of the blame, particularly among conservative Pakistanis, to blame the licentious and inverted commas woman.
That's actually a great point, because that is the way the equation works, and so he must have just thought, okay, well, whatever, I'm not gonna be hurt by this. It's the woman who always takes the blame, so she probably won't even dare to put these out. But she does dare to put them up, and that's when a huge explosive outcry occurs in Pakistani society, where now she has literally shown the sort of dark or sexually repressed underbelly of the country, where even a cleric, and in particular a pretty prominent cleric in the sense that he served on that particular committee, is when no one's watching, he's up to this. So this idea of the shame culture, and Pakistan is a shame culture, which means it's very much pivoted on what is visible. So, you want to be visibly pious, you want to be visibly observant. And then, there's a sort of tacit understanding that whatever happens behind closed doors or what nobody sees is, no one's going to talk about it. And it has a almost like a sense of moral unreality.
How long after this meeting and how did her story end?
Well, I mean, it was the months after the meeting, I think, became very, very difficult for Kandil, because she was facing censure from lots of different quarters. She was afraid for her life. She didn't know how to proceed, really. And she ends up going to visit her parents in Punjab, in the city of Multan, and for the Eid holiday. She didn't want to be by herself in Karachi at her apartment, and she goes over there, and that night her brother and his friends drug the parents, so they won't hear anything, and they come in the middle of the night, and the brother strangles Kandil.
It's fair to say that the brother and the friend who committed this crime, there's no doubt about that they did it, but they are not, as we speak, in prison for it. They weren't convicted of it.
Well, they haven't yet been convicted of it, which is actually, it shows how these cases proceed. So in many cases, the parents or other family members, when it's an intrafamilial crime, the other family members can pardon the person that has actually done the crime, and there's no prosecution at all. In this case, her parents stayed very strong. They're very old and very poor. Her father is disabled, but they stuck to their guns all the way until this summer, when literally, I think maybe a month ago, they said that they were just tired of this case going on, as you can imagine, for so many years and not having any justice. So they were just going to go ahead and pardon their Wasim, who's the son that committed the crime.
So they pardoned the son for killing the daughter.
Right. And then again, there was outcry in Pakistan. And so now the Multan High Court in Multan essentially said that they were not going to accept that pardon and the case was going to proceed. So now, once again, the hearings are being held and, you know, Wasim and others have been produced in court. I'm not sure whether the cleric is out on bail or whether he is still under arrest. He's also one of the accused in the case.
But the broader point here is that there is a culture of, and I hate the phrase honor killings because it's clearly contains its own antithesis. It's a ridiculous phrase at one level because it's trying to justify the murder of someone through a specious account of what honor is. But they're called honor killings anyway. There is a culture in which if people say they're murdering someone or committing a crime against someone for the sake of morality, for the sake of reputation, it is very rare for them to be successfully prosecuted.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think your critique of the term is very apt. In Kandil's particular case, the reason why I feel, you know, that honor killing doesn't quite, you know, get to the nub of it is because she was a very particular creature of a society that's going through rapid urbanization, rapid access to the world through these internet technologies, and this consideration of what, you know, was once hidden becoming more and more apparent and more visible. So in this sense, there's not any sort of tradition or cultural element that, you know, because honor killing is, you know, it has this connotation of a cultural crime, that it only happens in particular cultures. But what happened to her was much more like, you know, a mix of celebrity worship versus, you know, these internet sort of provocateurs and bending the rules of society and pushing the boundaries and seeing what you can get away with.
It's an incredible story, Rafia. And, you know, and you can see the modern morality tale aspect for it. Thank you so much for taking the time to write about it for us and for talking about it with us now.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you. I kind of feel like I quite like her.
Well, yeah, and the story, you know, Rafia just told us the story and investigated it for us, but we should also say that the book itself by Sanam Maa, on which this a woman like her is the book, it's a really good book.
Yeah.
It was a real undertaking, I think, to produce. She went off to interview various people who met Kandil at various junctures in her life, and so many people wouldn't talk to her.
Yeah.
It's a real undertaking. It's a great book, and it's a great review of the book.
Because it's big. The problem is there's a sort of societal desire to suppress this stuff, which is hence the problem in itself.
Exactly.
Lovely. Great stuff. Well, Ernest Bloomsbury have published it, A Woman Like Her by Sanam Maa.
Every now and again, a film comes along that really, truly mesmerises. Bait, a film written, directed and edited, not to mention laboriously developed by the filmmaker Mark Jenkin, is such a film. Set in a small, unnamed Cornish fishing village, Bait centres on the tense relationships between Martin Ward, a local fisherman now unable to afford a boat, and the Lees, an affluent family from upcountry, whose arrival in the village has changed the very fabric of the place. The newcomers have bought up the old fishermen's cottages, including the one in which Ward and his brother were born, and turned them into shishi holiday rentals with complimentary bottles of fizz in each fridge. As Lamorna Ash says, writing in this week's TLS, early on comes the realisation that there is nowhere for the narrative to go but towards some form of tragedy. To this timeless tale of the clash between them and us, rural and metropolitan, tradition and the future, add a bold cinematic aesthetic reminiscent of Louis Buñuel and Salvador Dali's cut-up Dream Logic, and you've a film that lingers and unsettles long after the credits finish rolling. And the credits are, incidentally, very short, as you might expect, of a film with such a tiny budget. I saw Bait a couple of weeks ago, and I am still turning it over and over now. Lamorna Ash is here to tell us more. Hello, Lamorna.
Hi.
Had you heard much about Bait before you went to see it? And I ask this because I know that you're in some ways very much connected with Cornish fishing communities.
She's a Cornish fishing village expert.
Definitely not an expert. I actually was in Newlyn, in the village where Mark Jenkin came from, whilst I knew they were doing the filming.
Ah.
So I actually had met Callum, who was the script editor on the film, just afterwards. And he had that kind of amazing, because it had been filmed in 4 weeks and they'd all really lived amongst one another whilst making it. He almost had the come down of that, that he said it was the most extraordinary experience, because it was a film that Mark Jenkin, who had been trying to make, I think for 20 years, this has been the film he was sort of like waiting inside him. And so this was this amazing release of having finally made it together.
Wow. I mean, well, critics have been raving about it. Mark Kermode, I think he called it the British film of the decade or something like that.
Yeah.
What was your first impression of the film?
Well, you can't help but be surprised by it, because I think one becomes so used to the kind of cinema where you have these slick, beautiful, quick edits and everything is glossy and there's a CGI. And for to sit down and the screen to shorten, because it goes and it's all filmed in analogue and black and white, it's immediately so striking. And the first image, which is a close-up of the main character, and to hear the sound, so they filmed all of the sound was done in Foley Studios afterwards, and so it meant that Mark Jenkin got to choose what sound he wanted, in terms of, rather than allowing every single bit of sound. So you hear these really heavy footsteps and this close-up on this man's face, so it's immediately so striking and unlike other things I'd seen.
So who goes to see this? I'm interested always just in films, very auteur-y films, because like you say, they're not that common in some senses now. That, you know, one of the stories of the film industry is a kind of the overwhelming effect of franchises in Hollywood. Who goes to see this film? Who should go and see this film?
Well, I suppose it's easy to say that everyone should see it, but it doesn't. It's selling so well that, I mean, to begin with, it was just at Venice Film Festival. I don't think they knew that it would end up being on general release, but certainly when I went and saw it, the whole cinema was packed. And I think also there's that sense that somewhere that we know but don't know too well, the idea of somewhere in Cornwall, and we know about fishing communities and they have a loud voice and kind of in our understanding of what Britain is. So I think that appeals to people because they want to know more and they want to see that on a screen.
Well, and at its core, it is also a really good melodrama with real kind of strong strands. There's the, you know, the Romeo and Juliet strand almost.
My friends and I, we came out and we were kind of discussing that I don't know what it would have looked like if it had been fully in colour and if it had been filmed in a kind of the way you want to expect, because some of it is really heightened and melodramatic and almost soap operatic at times.
Absolutely.
And somehow, yeah, but when that's in black and white, because it comes strange and things are filmed out of sequence as well, it does something so much greater and kind of, I don't know, more profound than what it would have done in colour, I think.
Did you struggle at all? Is there a struggle with Jenkin's approach to characterisation? Because, I mean, it's uneven.
In terms of the fact that the other characters are sort of awful, the English characters.
Yes. Hugo.
I don't know.
English as opposed to Cornish.
Well, they're down from up there. They're presumably down from London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it you drawing a distinction between English and Cornish? That's a distinction.
But no, I'm drawing the distinction between the way Jenkin portrays the locals.
Yeah.
And everyone, yeah, everyone else.
Yeah, I wondered about this because definitely the daughter of the Lays, who's kind of spends a lot of the time rolling her eyes at her family and ends up going out with one of the fishermen, she seems to transcend that kind of stereotype that they do for the rest of the characters, as sort of like English, upper class, tight-lipped, difficult, not quite understanding the rest of the village, and saying we're part of this community while clearly having a detrimental impact on it. But when I thought about it, I thought you always have to think about the intention of the auteur, and he didn't want to tell a story that showed the complexities of tourists and the complexities of English people, and I suppose there are enough of those films, but for him this is what the people from those villages see, and they only get these people for a couple of weeks over summer. Perhaps when they are on holiday and the youngsters are getting drunk and perhaps are not behaving how they ought to. So I think it makes a lot of sense to not allow them to be complicated, difficult characters and to just focus on the Cornish characters being that. It's hard to see, but I think it works the way he's chosen to do it.
Can I ask a foolish question?
Yeah.
Are we in the realms of a parable about divided communities and rural and metropolitan and them and us and people with a different sense of what a community should be? Are we in dreaded B word, not bait, territory here?
Yes, we definitely are. And I think Jenkins has been asked this because I saw it in some interviews. He's been asked this by a lot of people at the film premieres and different...
Sort of obvious question I would ask if I were interviewing him, to be honest.
Yeah, well, actually, so a really interesting thing is, because, again, they did the sound afterwards, so they were able to kind of play however they wanted to. So when there's one point when they do amazing intercuts between the fishermen laying out nets and then the family inside the house, and they've got Radio 4 playing on their MacBook as they're drinking expensive white wine, and it's actually a Brexit story. So it's very quiet and you can barely hear it, but it's kind of that wink to say we know that this is that time and that this is a really important thing to be thinking about. So it's definitely in there.
And what's his argument? Because from what you're both saying, there's a certain reduction to simplicity, which in lots of respects is never helpful when talking about Brexit. You know, everything's always oversimplified to the point of polarization. Is he making a point that is sufficiently nuanced to be a worthy contribution to all of this?
I think definitely, because it's a character study, so it's not facts and figures and there's no propaganda involved, but it just shows you very clearly something that's definitely happened in Cornwall. Well, I don't know if this is about Brexit so much, but the fact these communities are so poor and they are angry and they're trying to direct that anger towards something. And certainly in Cornwall, where the majority did vote Brexit, that seemed to be towards immigration and kind of things that actually weren't happening in Cornwall. But that's what he's trying to show is more localized than that. And that's the way that that community is being dislocated, and the way that, so everybody who actually grew up in the village has now moved to council property further inland and they kind of recreate their community there. So I think actually the hostility is more towards maybe the upper class families who've come in, and the fact that no one protected these properties. So it meant that now I think they've changed it and there's some new laws coming in so that you can't have as many second homes or you get taxed more. So that's starting to change.
Any cries about simplicity or the use of archetypes and whatever in this film is mitigated to a great degree by the aesthetic, the style of it. Because he's chosen such a strange to the normal, kind of to the normal cinema goer's eye approach to it, it does unsettle those kind of.
But is that right? I found that really interesting, because I hear both of you making that argument. But you know, and I'm not saying it's having seen it, I'm just interested on the broader point that just because you film something in black and white, just because
that's not what it's about.
But what I'm saying is, if you're shifting the aesthetic, does that justify the narrative?
It creates a distance, and it makes you look at it and listen to it differently. And especially with the sound, something really peculiar happens with him having put the sound on afterwards, where language becomes kind of unhinged from what's happening. So there's this one scene where the Lees arrive down in their big Range Rover and park outside and go to the front door, open it up, and someone else arrives from wherever it is that they've come from, up country as well, and the two women, who both look pretty similar, look at each other and say, "Oh, so you've arrived too?" And the other one says, "Yes, 7-hour drive." The other one rolls her eyes and says, "Oh, well, at least we're here." And the other one then just goes, "Yeah." And it's the most inane, just banal exchange there. And it just, there's just this slight disjointing, which just makes you then for the rest of the film just listen to language and exchanges differently. It's very difficult to explain why that's important, apart from that it just is.
Do you buy that, Lamorna?
I think, yeah, I do. I think what I was going to say as well is that it's not that one justifies the narrative. I don't think that you can, I don't think you can split them in that way. I think they're so intertwined that the way that that story works is a part of the filming. But I don't think it's that one justifies the other. They just, they grew together. Mm-hmm. So it's this style that Jenkins has been working on for years, and his other amazing short films on YouTube similarly use this style where it's all the sound comes afterwards. So, and I think it plays into the writing because it's something that he is used to doing now, where he says that the writing, the language doesn't actually matter that much, but it's almost just this strangeness that comes in occasionally. And often they are talking in, I don't know, just a few kind of Cornish dialect words and strange things that it's almost like the words don't matter so much.
And it made you think. And it made you think what you said. What I find fascinating is because you've someone who is not just a tourist to Cornwall. You've gone to study it. You've lived there as someone who's writing about it, which is slightly different. But it has unsettled you, this film, hasn't it? Because it's basically made you think, hang on a second, am I the sort of person who doesn't belong?
Yeah, I think I've known that for a long time because despite my mum grew up in Cornwall, but I will be that voice. I will always be the posh Londoner when I go down to Cornwall. And I'm really aware, and it's been a kind of sad thing maybe of growing up a place, thinking about the impact you'll have if you move somewhere, that, you know, you don't just get to go somewhere and say, this is now mine, I'm now part of this. And you can return to it and you can have a positive impact and you don't necessarily have to cause harm. But I realise you can't just uproot yourself and say, okay, I'm now part of your community.
Why not? Because why not? Is that not what you know, no one owns a community, no one owns a patch of land.
No.
Like, there's a kind of
clubbiness that is frustrating. Maybe I'll change my mind later about this. But
I think it reflects well on you, Lamorne. I think there is a certain insularity that frustrates the hell out of me. I don't feel I own any part of the world where I grew up or otherwise. Why should anyone have the temerity to say this place is theirs more than
yours?
I think it's that if you move somewhere, someone else is maybe moving away. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't, but it's being conscious of that. How can I join a community and not make it worse? Or how can I join a community and truly become a part of it? And I do think it's difficult because if you're going somewhere where for you the rent feels a lot cheaper, that means that the people who can't afford that are moving out. And I don't know, and if you're going to have a second home, it means you're not going to be there over the sort of quite a lot of the seasons, and therefore it becomes like a ghost town and other people who live there all their lives can't afford to be there. I just think it's worth being conscious of.
I think also there's a distinction, is there not, between second homes with the economic consequences, as you say, of second homes versus moving somewhere.
There's an ecosystem and there's a balance to be struck, and one house is enough for everyone.
But there's a kind of British cliche here, and you get it in Yorkshire as well, that people who've only been there 150 years are not welcome and they're seen as newcomers because there is this insularity where having been part of a place is seen as a virtue, and which transmits itself as a certain standoffishness, and that's often treated as praiseworthy, and to me it seems the very opposite of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that I was really shocked the first time I went because I'd never thought that way. And I had that kind of young person thing of I want to go everywhere and I want to belong everywhere. And I don't think I've ever heard someone say that you can't. Well, maybe you can, but I don't know. I think because in London, it really is. Everyone is from everywhere and there's a place for everyone in a way. And I understand it, but it doesn't work in quite the same way. And I don't know, I think it also comes because we're talking about this late in the game, that these places have already changed a long time ago. So actually some of it is a sorrow about something that's already happened. So when more people come, it's almost like they're nostalgic for a shift that happened to those communities a long time ago. Places like Mousel are already entirely tourist villages. No one lives there anymore that grew up there, really.
Yeah, and look, to be honest, we're not going to do it. I think it's what's interesting about this film, the way you've both talked about it and the way you've written about it, Lorna, is it makes you think about those issues of belonging and
place. Anything that is strange enough to make you look at something that you might see every day just a little bit differently or listen to it a little bit differently, that's I think the point.
All right, I'll shut up.
Go and see it.
Fine, be like that. I'll go see it. Lamorna, there you go. I could get the sense of that from both of you. Lamorna, thank you very much indeed.
No worries at all. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's an interesting. The idea of the value of place is an interesting one. But you love this film.
I did love this film.
Is it short?
I think it's about an hour and a half. It's the perfect film. It's like the 3-minute pop song.
Yeah,
perfect.
That's all you want. That's all you want. That's all. Talking of things going on too long, that's all we have time for this week. Thanks go to Lamorna Ash, Irina Dumitrescu and Rafia Zakaria. Get your copy of the TLS this week for a Middle Eastern special and all sorts of other good stuff. Or do get subscribing. Next week, we look more particularly at the issue of gender, fathers, mothers and Susan Sontag. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.